may be seated. Our next case is 12-1727, matter of Yanko Mansere versus the State of Ohio for the appellant, Mr. Gutkowski.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Brian R. Gutkowski. I am on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, the Office of Tim McGinney, and here speaking on behalf of the State of Ohio. I'd request 3 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Mansere today asks you to rewrite the wrongful imprisonment statute's 2003 amendment to fit his situation instead of the manner it's written. We ask that the court decline that invitation and hold that the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary rule is inapplicable to a subsequent civil proceeding for wrongful imprisonment under the statute, and furthermore, that the final element of that statute, Revised Code 2743.48A5, bars an action for wrongful imprisonment when the claimant's alleged error in procedure is a trial court's denial of his motion to suppress, and that evidence is subsequently admitted, or that ruling on the suppression motion is subsequently reversed by an appellate court, and the state declines to retry that defendant. In the proceedings below, Mr. Mansere, his underlying criminal conviction, the evidence specifically before the trial court and the appellate court, is specifically limited to his complaint. However, the underlying criminal case, the factual basis for that prosecution involves the U.S. Marshals' search for a man named Rodney Williams. They had information that Mr. Williams was staying in Mr. Mansere's residence, and they were looking for Mr. Williams pursuant to a federal warrant for his arrest.
Counsel, would you maybe move the microphone a little closer? I'm having difficulty hearing you.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Again, they were looking for Mr. Williams. They went to Mr. Mansere's home. They knocked on his door. Mr. Mansere answered. They said, "Is Rodney Williams staying in your house?" He gave conflicting statements as to when the last time he saw Mr. Williams was. They did a sweep of the house. They didn't find Mr. Williams, but what they found was a lot.
Did they have a warrant?
They did not have a warrant when they went to Mr. Mansere's home. They did a protective sweep of the house. They found a substantial quantity of ecstasy pills in plain view. At that time, they exited the house. They proceeded to get a warrant from the Common Pleas Court. Upon their return, they also found two handguns. Mr. Mansere filed a motion to suppress all the evidence that was obtained in his house. The trial court heard testimony and evidence on that motion. The trial court denied that motion. Mr. Mansere then exercised his right to go to a jury trial. A jury convicted him of drug possession and drug and having a weapon under disability. He was sentenced to 11 years in prison. Upon appeal to the 8th District Court of Appeals, the decision, again, as I mentioned, was overturned. The state elected to appeal to this court. Chief Justice O'Connor and Justice Lanzinger thought that the case should be held for another Fourth Amendment case that they were hearing at the time, State v. Gould. However, a majority didn't elect to take Mr. Mansere's case. Had two other justices done so, he might still be in prison at this time. Nonetheless, upon his release from prison, the state obviously couldn't proceed with the criminal case since all its evidence was suppressed. He filed a wrongful imprisonment action against the state of Ohio. Now, under wrongful imprisonment law, there's five things that a claimant has always had to prove. Those are that he was charged with a felony, he didn't plead guilty to it, he served his time in state prison, the prosecutor can't or won't seek an additional trial, and the final element prior to 2003 always read that subsequent to sentencing or during or subsequent to imprisonment, a court of common pleas determines that either he didn't do it or no one did it. In 2003, the legislature added a error in procedure prong in the existing version of A5. Such that it now read, after 2003, subsequent to sentencing or during or subsequent to imprisonment, comma, an error in procedure resulted in release. Now, based on the plain language of A5, upon receipt of Mr. Mansere's civil action for wrongful imprisonment, the state of Ohio filed a motion to dismiss his case because based on the plain language of A5, his claimed error in procedure didn't happen subsequent to sentencing or during or subsequent to imprisonment. The trial court agreed with the state's position that he was explicitly disqualified under that language, A5. and dismissed his case. He appealed to the 8th District again. The 8th District gave a troublesome opinion because basically what the Court of Appeals did was interpreted the statute in a manner that it isn't written. The bottom line here is that the statutory language as written says that the error in procedure has to occur subsequent to sentencing or during or subsequent to imprisonment. His error is either the police raiding his house without a warrant or the trial court overruling his motion to suppress. Neither of those events happened subsequent to sentencing or during or subsequent to imprisonment. Therefore, he lost his case in the trial court. The 8th District Court of Appeals disagreed with that interpretation. They held that a qualifying error can occur prior to sentencing or prior to imprisonment, despite the statutory language.
Well, counsel, I'm looking at the Court of Appeals decision. They say that your position is absurd, which I think is rather harsh language. Wouldn't you agree?
I do think it's harsh, Judge O'Neill, or Justice O'Neill.
But they say that an individual is wrongfully imprisoned only when the error occurred after he was sentenced is illogical. And I think I do have a problem with that. Are you suggesting that only errors happening after the sentence is imposed would trigger the statute?
That's what the statute says, Judge. That's what a plain reading of the statute says. That's our first goalpost when we're looking at a statute is what does the legislature say?
So what type of error then would be an illustration of that? Can you think of anything that would help us understand?
Sure. There's a number of errors that could happen that I mentioned before in the briefs. The one that comes to mind would be consider the hypothetical where someone is a criminal defendant is sentenced to prison. He's also, as a condition of his prison sentence, to post-release control. He's released from prison. While on post-release control, he reports to his parole officer and submits a drug sample, and the sample comes back that it tests positive for a prohibited substance. That individual is sent to prison. A year goes by, and the lab calls up the parole officer and says, you know what, we thought we were testing Mr. Jones' sample, but it turns out we were testing Sally Field's sample, and the samples were switched. And there was an error. Well, the parole officer gets on the horn and calls the Department of Corrections and gets the claimant released from prison. That would be clearly an error that happened after he was sentenced that resulted in his release. But again, I wasn't in the room when the House Commercial and Civil Law Subcommittee added this prong, and when we look at their legislative history, they don't unfortunately define what they meant by error in procedure.
Can I ask a question along those lines then? If we agree with the 8th District Court of Appeals, is it your view, therefore, that every single person who has a conviction reversed is entitled to compensation?
Well, that's certainly not my position. That would be what the claimant's position in this case would be. Frankly, they want you to completely disregard the statutory language, and instead of subsequent to sentencing or during or subsequent imprisonment, they want to substitute the language, a reviewing court finds reversible error. That's essentially what Mr. Manzuri wants this court to interpret the existing statutory language to read, and that's not the way it's written, and that's not what this court should do. If they were to do that, frankly, the floodgates would be open. There would be a 6-year look-back period for every Court of Appeals decision where a criminal defendant was successful on appeal, and there would be a flood of litigation throughout the state of Ohio.
For doesn't every reversal require an error in procedure?
Well, I can't say whether or not an error in procedure necessarily is required for a reviewing court to reverse someone's criminal conviction. But what I do know is that the General Assembly certainly didn't contemplate paying compensation out of the state's coffers to criminal defendants who are fortunate enough to get their conviction reversed on appeal.
But how do we know that? I'm over here. How do we know that? You said it's clear to you that that's not what the General Assembly intended.
Right.
But how do we know that from the language?
Well, If the court determines the statute ambiguous, it can consult the various tools listed in Revised Code 1.49 for guidance, and one of those tools is the explicit legislative history that's published pursuant to Senate Bill 149, which is what the enabling statutory basis for the Aaron Procedure Clause. And when we look at that, it's in the record, was attached to this motions to dismiss. The general consensus was it specifically states that this is not a huge change. Specifically, if I'm paraphrasing here, but it says this will cause no additional work for courts of common pleas that make these determinations. So that doesn't line up with opening the floodgates to every criminal defendant that alleges a pretrial or pre-arrest Aaron procedure caused my release. That doesn't equate.
But the defendants would also have to show the other eligibility requirements, correct? And is there a dispute here about whether Mr. Mansouray does meet those other eligibility requirements?
There is a dispute. The 8th District said that it was undisputed, but frankly, that's not particularly correct. The trial court rightly, when it's reviewing a motion to dismiss, takes the facts as pled in Mansouray's complaint as true, and he's pled that he meets all those requirements. However, he can't necessarily show, based on this court's ruling in Gover v. State, which interpreted A4. In Gover v. State, which was a 1993 case, this court held that a claimant, in order to be compensated based on wrongful imprisonment law, has to show that not only is he not guilty of the offenses which he was ultimately exonerated or the case was on appeal, but he has to show that he was innocent of any criminal conduct arising out of his interaction with that particular case. For instance, the record here wouldn't be clear until a motion for summary judgment was submitted, but if for a hypothetical situation, Mr. Mansouray had a child in his residence, the presence of 1,300 doses of ecstasy and two handguns would conceivably be child endangering under Ohio law, which would effectively disqualify him for wrongful imprisonment compensation. The important point here to recognize is that the legislative history says that this isn't a huge change in the body of law, that continuing and prior law is what they specifically say in their notes on this topic, and that this court has always interpreted this statute, frankly, in a limited manner so as to make a claimant specifically show his entitlement by a preponderance of the evidence as to each element of the wrongful imprisonment statute. Taking that into consideration, we would ask that the 8th District's decision be reversed. It appears the red light's on, so is my time?
The red light's not on.
Oh, I thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Basically, proceeding in the example as I quoted, that if this court were to allow the 8th District's decision to stand, what in effect would have happened is that the Aaron procedure prong, which was supposed to be limited and not cause any drastic changes in Ohio law, will have effectively swallowed the actual innocence prong of the statute, which is what was always there, and what the General Assembly specifically stated in its legislative history was continuing in prior law. So as this court has already determined that the purpose of the wrongful imprisonment statute is to truly compensate somebody that's been wrongfully imprisoned. It's not to compensate somebody that's merely avoided criminal liability. And there can't really be a better example of somebody that's merely avoided criminal liability than somebody that is successful on appeal on a Fourth Amendment motion to suppress issue. Take, for instance, somebody that is my red light is not now, so I will save the balance of my time.
You could have done that earlier if you wanted to. There was no mandate that you stand there and, just for future reference.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Okay. Counsel.
May it please the court, Justice O'Connor. My name is Terry Gilbert. I represent Yanko Mansouray. Looking at this statute from its inception, the first 15 years of this statute only had one basis in order to make a claim for wrongful imprisonment, and that was basically innocence.
Counsel, would you speak into the microphone?
I'm sorry. And in 2003, the legislators decided to add and expand the availability of that remedy to a new class of individuals without regard to the question of avoiding criminal liability or innocence or non-innocence, it dealt with the question of error in procedure.
And but they also limit the occurrence of that error in procedure with language of during or subsequent to sentencing or imprisonment, correct?
Correct. But no, I'm not agreeing that it had the error had to occur.
But that's the language that's contained in the statute.
Well, I think the plain reading of the statute is that only errors that result, if you have to, you have to look at the whole phrase there, and I know there was a lot of attention in the briefs to the science of grammar, and I don't want to get into it, but the statute says subsequent to sentencing and during or subsequent to imprisonment, an error in procedure resulted in the individual's release. It doesn't say that the error in procedure has to occur. If the legislators wanted the timing of the error to actually occur after the sentencing, they would have put it in there. But the key modifier is the entire phrase that the error results in the release. Now, if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, criminal procedure, it's the kind of thing, and I want to raise the case of State versus Hill, which was not in the briefs. It's the 10th District, same exact case, motion to suppress, comes back, files a wrongful imprisonment case. They went through the whole analysis and said that the plain reading of the statute is in the context of criminal procedure and error in procedures that it agrees with the 8th District that it's absurd to think that they're limiting it to only errors in procedures that occur after sentencing. It would make no sense. It would make the effective nature of that prong that was enacted in 2003 meaningless.
But Mr. Gilbert, my question to your opposing counsel is now to you. Where do we go from this case? Because it seems to me that any time there is a reversal of a conviction, there's going to be an error in the proceedings that is being pointed to that caused the conviction.
Well, we're not saying that every reversal criminal case results in the kind of errors that are involved in this case.
I understand what you're saying, but I guess I'm more troubled by what you're asking us to say.
Well, I think I would ask the court to agree with both the 8th District and the 10th District, which says that an error procedure is one in which it results in the release. But for that error, that person would never have been imprisoned. If the error had been spotted, for example, within the context of the trial, before the person went to prison, that person never would have gone to prison.
But that would be everyone.
Pardon?
Wasn't the error alleged in the suppression?
Yes, but it didn't get determined until
it was rejected
by the trial court.
Exactly.
But the appellate court decided that the trial court committed error by not granting the motion to suppress.
Right.
When that decision was made by the appellate court, which was also affirmed by, this court rejected taking it in, at that point, the case was remanded back to the trial court, and the state of Ohio had no evidence in which to proceed to trial, but he went to trial anyway. He did not plead guilty. He went to trial. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to prison, and years later, when the appeal evolved into the Court of Appeals, that court found a fundamental constitutional violation, to wit, that the Fourth Amendment was violated.
Right, but I guess that's my question to you, it remains. Get away from the Fourth Amendment for a moment.
Okay.
Every time there's a reversal, there's going to be an error, or there wouldn't be a reversal. You will agree with that, will you not?
Yeah, there's going to be an error, but not all errors constitute a basis for a wrongful imprisonment. It's only those errors which result in imprisonment and a release from imprisonment.
So anytime the Court of Appeals would reverse a case or overturn a case and an individual was in custody, you're saying that makes the individual eligible for compensation.
That's where the qualifiers in the other four sections of the statute come into effect. If a case comes back and it's just on a basis of some kind of evidentiary issue, such as improper admission of 404B, let's say.
That is an error in procedure?
It's an error in procedure. It comes back to the trial court. The prosecution has the right to proceed with other evidence that it might have. And we can go to trial on that case, and the jury can make a decision one way or the other. So there are classes of errors, and I think this was pointed out in the 10th District decision, that don't automatically require, it has to be an error which does not allow the state to proceed with the trial.
So you're not saying in your scenario there that then if that case were appealed and the individual were, the appeal was in the individual's favor, that would fall within this category?
If the case went back to trial second time?
If the individual were, let's say, acquitted, or the court said, you would have a right to go back to trial. So you're saying that there has to be an ultimate release, and that's what makes
because as the 10th District said in Hill, when you have a case such as a motion to suppress, which takes basically obliterates the prosecution's case because there's no evidence to proceed, it pretty much precludes a re-prosecution. But meanwhile, the person has already spent who knows how long in prison. So the error in procedure, I'm talking about errors that are of a constitutional level.
Mr. Gilbert, yes. Did you say the case was remanded and retried by the state?
No, I'm sorry. What happened was the motion to suppress was denied by the trial court. He went to trial. He was convicted. He took the appeal on the motion to suppress to the Court of Appeals. They found error. They found that his Fourth Amendment violation took place. They then ordered it back, and the case was dismissed by the trial court.
By the trial court, because the state didn't have the evidence.
They didn't have the evidence.
Which satisfies the fourth criteria for the determination here.
Right.
And under the statute.
Right. So, counsel, if we
can go back to Justice Lansinger's question.
Yes.
On the definition of error in procedure, even if we were to agree with you on the temporal point of when it can occur, what does that mean? What is error in procedure? I mean, can you give us an example of an error that is not an error in procedure in a criminal trial? What would that look like?
An error in procedure in a criminal trial might be a...
No, I mean an error that is not an error in procedure. What doesn't qualify in this under the statute?
Everything.
I would say a evidentiary ruling.
Because that's rules of evidence as opposed to rules of procedure?
Procedures is a broad concept. Under Black's Law Dictionary, it says the rules governing the mechanisms under which crimes are investigated, prosecuted, adjudicated, and punished. Now, we may not like that it's so broad the way it's stated in the statute.
But that's not really my question. Yeah. I mean, I'm really struggling to understand what that phrase means and to give it a fair meaning. So to do that, I think I need to understand doesn't it include? I think the only example you've given is if you make an evidentiary mistake, that's not an error in procedure.
Because the prosecution may be allowed to retry that person even with that error.
But that goes to the other prongs. That goes to whether that defendant could be tried. Once that error is corrected, as you said, it goes back to the trial court, and then you have to make a determination, could the prosecution still have a case against this defendant?
Our position, if the error results in the release, and it's the kind of error that precludes re-prosecution, prosecutorial misconduct, Brady violations. There was one case, it was a speedy trial. Nelson, I think the name of the case was, where the speedy trial statute was violated.
And that's an error in procedure?
Considered, in the case of Nelson, was an error in procedure. That precluded the ability of the state of Ohio to prosecute the person.
What I hear you saying, though, is it's any error. The in procedure doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah, but
it's really about whether there's been an error.
Counsel, if a speedy trial was implicated, then there was there an incarceration under your scenario?
Yeah, there is a case, Nelson versus State of Ohio, in which the speedy trial motion was denied. It went up on appeal. The Court of Appeals said it was error for the court to deny the speedy trial motion, found that his rights under the speedy trial statute were violated, and it was remanded back, but pursuant to that order, the court could not proceed with a new trial.
But the defendant was already in prison.
Right. So what I wanted to finish the answer to your question, the error in procedure has to be of such a magnitude that it causes a release from imprisonment that is final. And, you know, that is wrongful imprisonment because, but for the error in procedure, that person would not be in prison. That person spent...
But what if the error cannot be duplicated? For example, what if it's an error in seating a jury and you've made objections to, I don't want an all-white jury, and you get one?
Right.
When it's remanded by the Court of Appeals, that case can be tried.
That would not qualify. That error would not qualify.
And is that an error in procedure?
It's an error in procedure, but it doesn't qualify because it doesn't necessarily result in a final preclusion of the ability of the prosecution to go forward.
Those are very nice words, but I can't find them in the statute.
I can't find the state of Ohio's interpretation in the statute either.
And
judges, I was here recently on the Lang Dunbar case, and I tried to do the same thing that Mr. Kutkowski is doing now by saying that a vacated plea had no legal effect of law, and I was shot down by that.
Let me take you to the facts of the case, Mr. Gilbert, to make sure I understand. Okay. This was originally an entry by the United States Marshals into a home without a warrant.
Correct.
And then presumably there was a warrant issued by a federal magistrate or a federal district court judge. Am I right about that?
Well, I think there was probably an arrest warrant in this case.
Okay.
For a different person.
Okay, maybe I'm mistaken. I thought when Mr. Gutkowski explained the facts of the case to us, when the marshals entered the home, they did not have a warrant.
They did not have a search warrant.
And then they subsequently returned with a warrant?
No.
Oh, that is not so.
No, I don't believe that's
the case.
So they
entered the home without a warrant and collected the ecstasy that was there.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. But I think what the state is trying to say that somehow it's unfortunate that that decision came down because we don't like the fact that people who escape criminal liability because of a suppression motion should be paid by the state. But that's something that he should bring to the legislature because they didn't say here error in procedure except for Fourth Amendment violations. And the fact of the matter is, all the case law preceding 2003 talked about the idea of this claim was not to allow people to collect for avoiding criminal liability. But that changed in 2003.
Oh, I understand that. Go ahead.
Mr. Gilbert, when you emphasize resulting in the individual's release, in this case, did the Court of Appeals release the defendant?
The Court of Appeals found that the motion to suppress should have been granted, remanded the case back Because the trial court has to enter some kind of final
decision. It wasn't remanded to release the defendant. It was remanded for further proceedings, which could have could have been trial. That's what I'm trying to get. If there's a distinction here, if the Court of Appeals, for example, were to say this error in procedure results in the individual being released right now, and if that's the case, I can see where your argument makes sense. But if we're saying that any time there's a decision by the Court of Appeals in the defendant's favor, and the case then continues on and allows that individual later to file for wrongful imprisonment, that's where I'm having trouble.
The statute just says results in the release. It doesn't say where a Court of Appeals orders a release. I don't think it makes any difference. It was the error that they found which caused him to be released.
But then you're talking released. About any eventuality. If the Court of Appeals is found in the defendant's favor because of the broadness of the word procedure, even a motion to suppress, you can argue it might be evidentiary, but it's still procedure. The court determined erroneously an error in procedure. You're saying then that any case would make an individual eligible if at one point they had the Court of Appeals ruling in their favor.
If they are released because of that ruling.
Right, and if they're released, then they're
which
eligible,
means,
you're saying.
That's what the legislation wanted to do. As hard as it is for some people to believe, because it's potentially innocent people get paid. But the integrity of the system is what they're talking about. There are such fundamental errors that people who would not have suffered those errors would not have gone to prison, and they do go to prison, and that's what they want. That is a different class of people who are wrongfully in prison. And I would suggest to the court that it's not up to the courts to decide whether it's a good policy or not. If people do not like the fact that people who avoid potentially criminal liability because they're victims of errors and procedures should not get compensation, then that's a matter to be taken up with the legislature. All right, so I just feel that the analysis in the Hill case, which came out after our briefs were filed, is right on.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, I believe you have a minute and 50 seconds left.
Thank you. Justice O'Donnell, there was a search warrant issued after the U.S. Marshals went in their home. It's technically not in the record because really what's only in the record in this case is the complaint.
Well, I understand it's a different case here, but my question was, who issued that warrant?
A common pleas judge, signed by Judge Bridget McCafferty, signed on the 8th of December, 2006. If you would like, I could submit it.
That was issued to whom? To the U.S. Marshals?
To Chief of Police Cleveland, Detective Matthew Bappler, badge number 1896.
And was that a search warrant or an arrest warrant?
It's a search warrant.
For the same premises?
Correct.
And when were the drugs, when was the ecstasy then taken by the U.S. Marshals?
The same day. They went back to the house after they conducted their sweep looking for Mr. Rodney Williams, but found a whole bunch of ecstasy.
And left the drugs there.
Well, they didn't leave the drugs. They seized the drugs because they were looking for the Mr. Williams, but nonetheless, upon their return, they also discovered two handguns.
So is this an exigent circumstance case on the warrant at the time? Is that what the claim was?
Well, certainly there's good cause for the officers to take a look for Mr. Williams because they had information that he was living at Yanko Manzeri's house.
And so my question then becomes, was the error that occurred here in issuing that warrant, is that the error that caused all of this?
I don't know. If the U.S. Marshals went to the house looking for Mr. Williams, they entered the house based on Mr. Manzeri's representations that he didn't know who he was, but upon further questioning, I might know him. That's why they entered his house. And again, two of the justices of this court thought that perhaps that case, his criminal case, should be held, and that, you know, if the majority of this court so determined, he could still be sitting
in
prison.
So
we didn't.
But
we know that the basis of the Court of Appeals decision was that the drugs should not have been taken despite the issuance of a warrant. Am I right?
Well, the Court of Appeals decision was essentially that they had no basis for entering the house, so that...
What was the purpose of the warrant?
Of the search warrant?
Yes.
To search the rest of the premises based on the fact they found 1,300 individual doses of ecstasy.
And what happened to the weapons charge?
Well, everything was found to be fruit of the poisonous tree and excluded.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors. I have one question before you leave.
I'm not sure I'm hearing you. The drugs were found and then the search warrant was issued?
That's correct, Judge O'Neill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.